afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Thursday, May 13th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Well, hello, Melody.
Hello. And how are we today?
Doing great.
Super. You sound different.
Do I?
Maybe
I'm talking with my microphone to my back. How's that? Is that better?
Wow, that's talent.
It's the microphone, not me.
Anyway, thank you. It's great to be here with you and the listeners and gold today. You know, it started out pretty choppy in the precious metals market today, and we had a nice little turnaround, up $11 for gold at $1,827. Silver was up 11 pennies at $27.20. Platinum was down 6 at $1,210. Palladium was up $9 at $2,917. The USDX today was down 0.09 at 90.68. Crude oil was down 230. I guess everything's all right in the world today. $63.78. Paper markets today, they had a turnaround too. Early morning trade, they were all negative. We had the Dow rebounding more than 400 points and 433 at 34,020. The S&P was up 49 at 4,112. NASDAQ was up 93 at 13,124. I'm real curious to see, well, even the 10-year yield, it was hitting 170. Now we're looking at 165 for the 10-year yield. European markets were mixed, and the Asian markets were all negative overnight. Nikkei took a hit, 2.5%, and that was the biggest hit. Was the Nikkei. So I guess Colonial Pipeline paid, what, $5 million to those hackers? It kind of makes me laugh because I was reading an article, Dave, where they were saying, oh, we're not going to pay the money. We're going to go in there and we're going to fix the problem ourselves. We're going to go back and recreate everything. And, well, $5 million.
Everyone has their price.
Absolutely. And we'll talk about that here, too. And today we had the first-time jobless claims. Looks like there were fewer folks who filed for them last week. And initial claims for state unemployment benefits totaled 473,000 for the week ending May 8th. The week before was 507,000. And we see the job openings are at a record, 8.1 million. We talked about that the other day. And we have nearly 10 million people who are officially unemployed. Now, of course, this is all according to the U.S. Labor Department. We know how good they are. And, of course, there's, you know, we've talked all the kinds of reasons, oh, you know, why people don't want to go back to work. It's an interesting place. I don't think I can ever remember a time in our economy, Dave, in our history, where people just didn't want to go back, didn't have to go back to work. Is that true? Was there any other time?
That's a good question.
I can't hear you, Dave.
Melody?
Yes.
Melody?
Yes, can you hear me?
That's a good question. I don't know of another time. I can't imagine this is the only time, but certainly the first time in modern history, if not ever, there'd been this level of enhanced unemployment benefits, the extent that we've seen over the past year. So it could very well be unprecedented.
I think so. Anything else you'd like to add to the numbers, the jobless claims?
Well, you know, that's as you alluded to. I mean, some people believe that the extra 300, it used to be 600 last year, the extra $300 a week government benefits could be encouraging some people, particularly those at the lower wage scale, to stay on unemployment rather than to return to work. And that particular, I mean, whatever the reason, economists are saying is keeping claims above the 200,000 to 250,000 range that they view as consistent with a healthy labor market. Jobless claims have dropped from a record roughly 6.2 million in early April last year. Now, a number of states like Tennessee and Missouri, as two examples, have a headline U3 jobless rate below the national average of 6.1%. They've announced that they're ending federally funded pandemic unemployment benefits next month. And, I mean, we know the government's provided just about $6 trillion in pandemic relief over the past year, and more than a third of the population's now been fully vaccinated, and it's leading many states to lift their capacity restrictions on businesses. The massive fiscal stimulus and the Fed's QE personified, plus this improving public health, have unleashed demand among consumers that's pushing up against a supply constraint, and that we know has been resulting in an acceleration in inflation. Speaking of which.
Yes. Speaking of which, I don't know. Our microphones are all wacky today, I think. Okay. Speaking of which, companies, they've paid much higher prices to producers in April. You know, we've talked about it, you know, from everything from steel to meat. But again, another sign of rising inflation in our economy. Now, this new data came a day after the sharp gain in consumer prices sent the stock market reeling. Although, as I just mentioned, it did turn around today. The PPI, the Producer Price Index, rose 0.6% from March. Now, this is according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Now, if you look at it on an annualized basis, the PPI spiked 6.2%. Now, this is the largest increase since the agency started tracking the data back in 2010. I mean, no one was expecting these numbers. I don't know why they weren't. They were talking about it, so I don't know why they weren't expecting them. The core PPI, which excludes, of course, food, energy, trade services, that rose 0.7% in April from the previous month and jumped 4.6% year over year. So now this increase from a year ago was the biggest jump since 2014. Producer price index came into focus after yesterday's consumer prices. I think that was, what, 4.2%?
Yeah.
4.2% from a year ago. But the producer price measures the prices paid to producers as opposed to prices at the consumer level, Dave.
Well, a sharp jump in, well, you mentioned, steel mill products contributed to the leap in the PPI in April. Prices for beef and veal, pork, residential natural gas, plastic resins, and dairy products also moved higher last month. Now, price for steel jumped over 18% from just a month earlier, while food prices edged up, they say, too. That seems low based on feedback, at least from my wife's visit to the grocery store. But in addition to rising prices, one of the main reasons for the big annual pace was because of base effects, meaning inflation, at least as measured by the government. That was very low at this time last year as the pandemic began shutting down big parts of the economy. Now, they're telling us that these annualized, these year-over-year comparisons are going to be distorted for the next few months. And the Fed has warned about these headline numbers, saying the spikes will be, again, there's this word, Melody,
transitory.
And, well, pick up in in inflation is normal as any economy reopens from a recession, or in this case, a pandemic and a recession. Investors fear it could squeeze companies' margins and, of course, erode profits, particularly if these prices are sustained over a longer period of time, which they undoubtedly will be in our minds. Now, Atlantic Fed Prez Rafael Bostic said he expects bouts of volatility around inflation through September. Others have been saying through the end of the first quarter, the second quarter, and June 30th. Others have been saying the end of the year, and others into the first of next. I guess we will see, and we will report accordingly.
Well, you know, we were talking about the pipeline. I don't know if you're going to talk about it later on in the program, but $5 million ransom was paid.
Yeah.
And $7 a gallon in Virginia. $7.
Holy mackerel.
So I don't think the government, I don't think the federal government said, no, you can figure it out on your own. No, pay it. Just pay it. And so it'll be interesting to see if they keep them any longer on hostage. And how, I don't know how soon they will release what they do. Once they receive the payment, the hackers provided the operator with a decrypting tool to restore its disabled computer network. The tool was so slow that the company continued using its own backups to help restore the system. A representative from Colonial declined to comment. As it did a spokesperson for the National Security Council, Colonial said it began to resume fuel shipments around 5 p.m. Eastern time yesterday. The hackers, with, you know, of course, it was a group called the Dark Side.
Interesting.
Yeah, it really is. You know, and the FBI discourages organizations from paying ransoms to hackers, but what are you going to do? Let gasoline go, let the economy and the whole country go belly up not to pay a ransom? I mean, they're going to. And it's kind of interesting.
We saw U.S. officials urging consumers not to fill up unnecessarily.
That alone in itself will make people do it.
Yeah, I know. It's like that'll, I mean, that therein lies another incentive to panic.
Yes.
And different agencies, transportation, EPA, are waiving certain regulatory requirements around the transportation of fuel, as well as the blending of it with ethanol and other products to waive these shortage concerns. And White House also said it had temporarily waived the Federal Jones Act. For a company it didn't name. The Jones Act mandates that goods transported between different U.S. ports have to be on U.S. flagged ships. So interesting week or so. There's also talk, I don't know if you saw it, Melody, about, you know, some people, Americans, asking, well, why can't we mandate that that these private companies be protect themselves more so that things like this don't happen. And, you know, right now the White House is staying away from that, saying, hey, they'll give everything the federal government can offer in terms of expertise, but it's up to these private companies in collaboration with the government to take care of these, what shall we say, vulnerabilities.
Yeah, but it's just pretty much like even individuals, you know, we don't pay attention, you know, to the importance and everything. Even our own government. I mean, we have Russia in there hacking into our computer systems and so forth, as we are probably hacking into everybody else's. And, you know, so there's an open window everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the dangerous part of having technology, these computers. My question is, you know, if these computer companies, these technology companies are so great, why aren't they coming up with something to protect businesses, computer systems other than, and even our own personal systems other than the little, you know, programs that you can buy and stick them on there and
yeah,
you still get hacked. You still get, you know, I mean, they're almost question. Worthless.
Well, it begs a question. Sorry for that phrase, listeners. I ask, where are these cyber attackers coming from? In fact, are they former industry players, Melody? Are these people who once programmed for the IBMs and Dells and the other, you know, the Intels of the world, who have now gone over to, hey, the dark side? And or are these other, you know, up and comers or, you know, folks that have been around out there for years on the fringe, you know, finding their way inside after, you know, God knows how many iterations and attempts of hacking into. But now, whether it's cyber security, cyber attacks or bad weather, I mean, we saw in Texas over the winter just how vulnerable our energy grid is. People begin. I mean, our leaders in public and private should really get in the ball here, make this a priority. We're pretty vulnerable.
We are, but look at all the tons of money that's being made by being vulnerable.
Yeah, how about it?
You know, and I agree with you. I'll bet there's insiders. I'll bet there's, you know, past programmers and up and it's probably a combination of everything.
Yeah.
You know, but still these technology companies, you know, and again, I mean, heck, they make your computers so they become obsolete after so many years. So if you need to use it as a business and so forth, you are forced to buy a new computer.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, planned obsolescence means more profit for the producers.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like it's so wrong. So everything is made to break so we can replace. Refrigerators don't last 30 years anymore. Hopefully they last 8. You know? And even our cell phones. Okay? How have they improved? Better pictures? Maybe a little faster? But what's faster is us running out of time. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk Radio. TeamUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody out for the rest of the program, taking care of clients in the office. Call her at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. If you want, look us up on the web at dgscoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our newsletter. Look for the mailbox. And you get our newsletter every Monday, our What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog on Friday, sometimes in between. We're there for you. It's all free. So here's some good news for the travel industry. We're seeing that multiple indicators now show how pent-up travel demand's playing out as the U.S. Continues to exit lockdown mode. Close to half of all Americans have had at least one dose of the vaccine, enabling a growing rebound in the hard-hit travel and leisure sectors. Now, more than half of the 8 million jobs lost in leisure and hospitality in March of April last year have come back, with 331,000 of those jobs added in April this year alone. April bookings were up 11% compared with April 2019. That's according to American Express Travel. And based on last month's figures, the vast majority of people are staying domestic, 87% in fact. The trend consistent across all age groups. But 39% indicate in a recent survey that they plan to travel internationally within a year. New York City, L.A., Atlanta, Dallas, Miami, Chicago, Charlotte, Denver, San Francisco, and Phoenix are the top 10 U.S. destinations, while Sydney, Melbourne in Australia, London, Dubai, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Paris top the list of international destinations. Now, pent-up demand for services, as we talked about briefly in the first segment, is on the rise, and most sectors here in travel, it's nearing the level of demand for goods. Flight bookings grew 11% alone in March, inching closer to e-commerce spending. Bookings for this year's December holiday season were up 17% at the end of March compared to March of 2019. Thanksgiving bookings are 9% higher. But the more lucrative business travel segment, they say, may never fully recover. As leisure returns, concerns about worker shortages, as well as their causes, grow. As we discussed on Tuesday, there were a record number of open jobs in the U.S. in March. The highest postings were for restaurants, bar, hotel, manufacturing, construction, and retail positions. It looks like a number of consumers are willing to pay $5,000 more than the sticker price of a new vehicle. As a global semiconductor chip shortage has led to a supply crunch at a time when demand for cars is literally soaring. The chip shortage has forced car manufacturers to idle factories and cut production, and that's creating a scarcity of new vehicles in the market. That's sending prices of both new and used vehicles surging. Cox Automotive is reporting that more than 40% of car shoppers are willing to pay above manufacturer's suggested retail price right now, and those willing to pay over that are willing to accept a 12% premium. That's interesting. While vehicle inventory is tight, access to auto loans has become more available for shoppers, and that's further boosting demand. So, again, is good news with a double-edged sword, again, in terms of inflation. Speaking of which, I know we've been talking an awful lot about inflation lately. Melody, Butch, and I. Yesterday, we got one of the hottest CPI readings in years, as we mentioned in the first segment. Going into it, there was already a lot of talk about it, inflation, and whether things were running too hot and whether Fed policymakers are making some kind of mistake by standing pat. And so the 0.9% month-over-month print ratcheted up the intensity of that debate dramatically. In addition to being a hot number, it was also an interesting and complicated number. I mean, actually, the economic data are very complicated in general right now. That's even for those who follow it every day. I mean, forecasters seem to be making errors left and right. We talked about that for several months, dating back to last summer, and I'm sure it's going on long before that, but deepened or intensified after the Labor Department admitted that its jobs numbers were quite unreliable. Last week's jobs report, too, also very confusing. For one thing, the pace of job creation seems to be falling woefully short of expectations, and that's giving mixed readings on whether the labor market is already tight or not. And as for inflation data, I mean, Matt Klein at Barron's, for example, he's a compelling column today arguing that the overshoot can almost entirely be attributed to the economic reopening from the pandemic. Even the surging price of used cars related to the reopening, because the heavy buyers are car rental companies that need to restock their fleets. So going back to the Fed for a second, obviously some people think they've made some kind of mistake. They're going too easy, buying too many assets, whatever, and they are. But some people believe you could also make the argument that they're actually being vindicated in their approach right now. Last summer, they spelled out their new framework where they established that they want to see sustained inflation above recent trends before they'd consider hiking again. Hiking rates, that is. They also want to see a sustained tight labor market that benefits a broad part of the population. Well, by focusing on the destination as opposed to the path, some say they've relieved themselves of trying to navigate the data in real time and come up with the right answer. And had we gotten this line under the old Fed framework, I mean, there'd be immediate pressure on them to act now and to think about hiking rates, even though the headline unemployment rate's at 6.1%. But perhaps the new framework, if nothing else, gives the Fed time to breathe a little, to see how things unfold rather than to do some real-time course correction using noisy data that's impossible to forecast, an economy that's engaged in an unprecedented reopening during a pandemic. It's crazy stuff out there, ladies and gentlemen. Not that I'm giving the Fed the benefit of the doubt. I'm just saying that, well, doing something, much less a lot, too much, too soon, is not a good answer. So we'll wait and see how the year progresses. Observers say another full-scale war is on the horizon in the Middle East. I mean, Palestinian militants fired more rockets into Israel's commercial heartland today as Israel kept up a punishing bombing campaign. Some of the videos were astounding. One high-rise or mid-rise apartment building, devastating, complete bombing, destruction of it. And this is going on in Gaza, and now Israel's massing tanks and troops on the border. 4 days now, cross-border violence. shows no sign of abating. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the campaign will take more time. And that certainly doesn't sound promising. The violence has also spread to mixed communities of Jews and Arabs in Israel. It's a new front in the long conflict. Synagogues were attacked and fighting broke out in the streets of some of these communities, and prompting Israel's president to warn of the danger of civil war. Worried that the region's worst hostilities in years could spiral out of control, the U.S. is sending an envoy. And truce efforts by Egypt, Qatar, and the U.N. have so far shown no signs of progress. Now, in renewed airstrikes on Gaza, Israel warplane struck the six-story residential building I mentioned that it says belonged to Hamas. Netanyahu said Israel has struck close to 1,000 militant targets in Gaza in total. At least 83 people have reportedly been killed. One gets the impression that it's going to end up, unfortunately, a lot higher than that. That's going to strain hospitals already under a heavy pressure during the pandemic. Seven people at least have been killed in Israel since Monday. That's according to the Israeli military. Now, Israel has prepared combat troops along the Gaza border and was in various stages of preparing ground operations, the military said. That's a move that would recall similar incursions during Israel-Gaza wars, in 2014 and 2008 and 2009. Health authorities in Gaza said they were investigating the deaths of several people overnight who they said may have inhaled poisonous gas. So that's another twist. President Biden said he hoped fighting will be closing down. That's wishful thinking, I'm assuming. Sooner than later, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called for an urgent de-escalation. But Netanyahu has said Israel will continue strikes against the military capabilities of Hamas and other Gaza groups. Israel launched its offensive after Hamas first fired rockets at Jerusalem and Tel Aviv in retaliation for Israeli police clashes with Palestinians near an Al-Aqsa Mosque in East Jerusalem during the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. The hostilities have opened a new front by fueling tension between Israeli Jews and the country's 21% Arab minority who live alongside them in some communities. Israeli President Reuven Rivlin, some say is mainly a figurehead, nevertheless called for an end to this madness. Prayer for the people of those countries. Okay, after that, it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. Happiness, weed, robots, and water. Whatever the theme, there's probably an ETF promoting a basket of stocks related to it. Thematic exchange-traded funds are an investment media side effect. Forget about GameStop and Viacom CBS and Archegos Capital. I mean, there's newfound retail investor interest in narrow exposure to hot corners of the stock market, specific ones, small ones and large alike, more launching to meet the moment. In the past quarter alone, inflows into thematic ETFs hovered close to all of last year's. More ETFs debuted in the U.S. last year than at any point in the past decade. This is a stock market unlike any other time in our history. Now, thematic ETFs have been around for years, mind you, and issuers are betting that new pandemic-era traders want niche exposure to crypto innovators, for example, and other types of areas. Professional sports, it's a big one. According to Todd Rosenbluth, who heads ETF and mutual fund research at the firm CFRA, said people are more risk tolerant in a low interest rate environment. They're willing to speculate. Well, don't we know with what's been going on, particularly in the crypto world? I mean, there's the allure of investors whose names have become more popular on social media, like Kathy Wood. Her ARK Innovation Fund is a poster child for the thematic phenomenon. It's also one of the biggest by assets. Thematic funds assets under management have more than tripled, roughly $133 billion in the last year alone. That's about 2% of all ETF assets. Now, the labels may sound good, but you have to look under the hood to make sure it's not a marketplace technique, a marketing technique, pardon me, and stuffed with other stocks that run counter to its advertised mission. And you used to see that a lot in other categories of mutual funds, for example. But thematic funds have shed about $1.6 billion in assets so far in May alone. Some returns are down too. The Woods flagship ETF declined more than 30% from its peak. It's a swift reversal. Returns for cloud computing and clean energy ETFs have also dropped after a stellar 2020. One investment mania that's ETF-less, Bitcoin. Well, guess what? That's okay in our book. However, unfortunately, a slew of financial bigwigs have applications in for Bitcoin ETFs. Regulators recently punted a decision to later this summer on whether to allow them. Unfortunately, I predict that if they're approved, and that's not a slam dunk that they will be, but if they're approved, I think we could see a run out of other stocks and particularly out of bonds. Into these Bitcoin ETFs, because it's just people have the fear of missing out. I mean, the SEC warned just yesterday about the risk of mutual funds with exposure to the Bitcoin futures market. Unfortunately, North America's first Bitcoin ETF was approved in Canada just earlier this year. The bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, if there's a theme that can be put into an ETF wrapper, it either already exists in an ETF wrapper, or it's under consideration. And that is this week's Levity is Golden, and that is the end of segment number two. Stick around for these important messages. We'll be back in just a few short minutes. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoices.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody. She is manning the phones at 1-800-375-4188. Now, with base effect, i.e. inflation, all the rage this month, we also have the one-year anniversary of the COVID crash. We have the federal budget deficit. And now the Treasury reported April's government revenue spending, its monthly report. And while the data in isolation are nothing short of stellar, at least compared to last April's blowout $738 billion deficit, the data aren't pretty either. Last month, the Treasury collected $439 billion in receipts. And that's a solid improvement over the $267 billion in March, and 81% higher than the $242 billion in receipts collected last April, when the economy was in free fall. Now, we note that $7.2 billion of the money collected by the Treasury were Federal Reserve remittances from its profits, we'll call them, on its unprecedented QE program. Now, outlays, while ugly at $665 billion, were also an improvement compared to the $927 billion in March. That's when it funded the latest Biden fiscal stimulus. It was down 32% from the $980 billion last April, when Congress and the White House unleashed the first stimulus. Thus, the resulting April 2021 deficit was only $225.6 billion, a fraction of the near record $738 billion deficit recorded a year ago, but still staggeringly high. Despite the modest relative improvement in April, on a year-to-year date basis, the picture's never been uglier. In the 7 months through April for fiscal year 2021, the Treasury collected $2.1 trillion. We'll go out another decimal point and say $2.14 trillion in revenue. It spent 90% more, $4.075 trillion. 7 months in, 5 months to go. As a result, 7 months into the fiscal year, the year-to-date deficit stands at a record $1.93 trillion, compared to $1.48 a year ago. Although whether 2021 overtakes 2020 on the whole depends if and when Congress will pass any infrastructure and other stimulus programs this fiscal year. In short, ladies and gentlemen, the checkbook is open and ready for more red ink. I don't expect it to dry out anytime soon. Do you? All right, here's speaking of base effects and more inflation. Early glimpses of global inflation are emerging in odd places like trail cameras. Consider this: surging prices for materials like plastic resin, electronics components. They've made the cost of manufacturing these cameras used by wildlife hunters, for example, about 6% more expensive this year alone. That's according to Bryant Chan, who's president of Hong Kong-based manufacturer Wynwood Corporation. Chan has seen prices for raw materials surge across the board this year so far, pressuring factories like his to pass along their rising cost to overseas customers. Data this week show that producer prices in China climbed by the most since 2017, last month. The big question is how much of those higher costs will eventually flow from China to the rest of the world. Well, Bloomberg's Joe Wiesenthal says manufacturers are well used to volatile price swings, and his interviews with executives are finding that they will look for cost savings before raising prices. Indeed, the flow through so far, anyway, seems contained, despite, you know, the 6% increased producers and 4% annualized consumers last month. Raw material prices rose 15% in April from a year ago, the latest PPI report shows, which was more than the 5.4% increase for manufactured goods. Still, the same executives are also quick to point out that this time seems different, with a blitz of events converging all at once. I mean, shipping containers are in short supply, semiconductors are scarce, commodity prices are through the roof, and consumers are just hungry for more. Which Wiesenthal says is why they're warning that some pass-through is inevitable, with prices on the factory floor in China likely to surface in a shopping mall near you. Research by Standard Chartered shows the correlation between China's PPI and U.S. consumer prices has been as high as 0.61 in recent years. Now, correlation of 0.5 is essentially the divide between positive and negative correlation. So it's not great, but it's solidly on the positive side. Wilson Lam of Chiquang Metal Products and Electroplate Factory said, I think we can absorb all these cost increases. It's just a matter of time before we pass them on to our customers, though. His company. Lam's company makes packaging for global cosmetic and perfume brands and metal caps and other accessories for whiskey and cognac bottles. And China's not alone in this regard. In other manufacturing giants, including the U.S., Germany, South Korea, are also experiencing these higher costs. The Bloomberg Commodity Spot Index, which tracks global prices for 23 raw materials, rose this month to its highest point since 2011, 10 years ago. It's climbed more than 70% since reaching a four-year low in March just last year, all of which is why some are arguing that the world is headed for a sustained period of faster inflation. And that's really what we're keeping our eyes on for those kinds of signs. Because I think if nothing else, it's going to provide us with an insight of when the Fed is likely to make its next move. And that will have, I think, a profound, at least short-term impact on the stock market. Others think it might have a devastating impact, but and just the reverse for gold and silver. We shall see, but Michael Shaw, who's CEO at Marketfield Asset Management, notes that unlike the period after the Great Recession, when demand was weak, this time feverish demand, coupled with these shutdown or choke supply chains, point in just one direction, and it's not a good one. He believes this has potential to be a much more severe and longer lasting reflationary period with the consequent risk that it spills over into a more damaging inflationary impulse. Tuned. Now, speaking of rental cars, which we talked about earlier in the program, we've been talking a lot recently about meme stocks and the lack of oversight that's led to the recent GameStop and Archegos Capital fiascos. But Hertz was the original meme stock no one could make sense of. Robinhood fueled stock frenzy after the car rental giant's May 2020 bankruptcy filing That created finger wagging and ridicule and lots of questions. But it turns out, well, in this case anyway, that the day traders were right. Hertz's latest bankruptcy plan, where Knighthead Capital and Certares management will buy the company for $7.4 billion, calls for equity holders to receive about $8 a share. Usually, shareholders of bankrupt companies lose their entire investment, while distressed debt investors make money by taking over the company. Well, that's not happening this time, or at least it doesn't look like it. The unusual payout stems from a string of rare events that make it unlikely to be repeated very often, if at all. Those circumstances include a once-in-a-generation pandemic, unprecedented government intervention in market liquidity, and supply chain issues that more recently have made car rental rates skyrocket. Hertz filed for Chapter 11 after car rental volumes evaporated at the onset of the pandemic last year. The technical reason the company headed to court is that it effectively got a margin call on debt backed by its fleet of cars when the refinancing market was also all but shut down. Hertz stock was around $3 per share at the time and shot up as high as 6.25 in June. Well, that stock euphoria was ignored and ridiculed by investors who thought they knew better, mostly in the bond market. The company's unsecured bonds were trading at a mere 30 cents on the dollar, and they stood in line to be repaid in full with funds from a bankruptcy sale ahead of the stock. But soon after Hertz filed, people were already renting cars again for an upcoming travel season in the summer that would lack the option of European vacations or flying to islands. I'm sorry, that was last year. An unexpected bidding war this past month resulted in billions more to hand out to pre-bankruptcy investors compared with Hertz's original debt repayment plan. Look, the rapid fall in K-shaped recovery in the economy and markets has created many winners and losers. It just so happens this time Hertz shareholders are among the lucky. Now, let's jump to our friends here from Wall Street on Parade. After just 49 days of wedded bliss, Elon Musk is divorcing Tesla from accepting payment for its cars in Bitcoin. Oh, boy. Cry the tears. It was just March 24th that Musk first tweeted that Tesla would start accepting payment for its cars in Bitcoin. And in this week's Wall Street on Parade, Pam and Russ Martins ask, what caused the latest Saturday Night Live host's abrupt flip-flop? Well, Musk claims he wants to move the world toward a more environmentally sustainable future, ergo electric Tesla cars. And Bitcoin, well, it's a sharp contradiction to that position. According to the Cambridge Bitcoin Electricity Consumption Index, yes, there is such a thing, although it's known really as CBECI, Bitcoin's consuming more terawatt hours than Sweden or Malaysia, and close to the consumption of Egypt, a nation of 104 million people. Now, terawatt hours are a standard unit used to measure electricity consumption. You probably knew that. Here's another not-so-fun fact from the CBECI. The amount of electricity consumed by the Bitcoin network in 1 year could power all tea kettles used to boil water in the United Kingdom for 33 years. Wow. Boy, I mean, not only could that take care of the royal family for the next three decades, but the entire country. Go figure. Now, there's a trivia question to ask your next dinner party guests. In November 2018, researchers at the Nature magazine wrote that production of Bitcoin generated about as much carbon dioxide over 30 months as 1 million cars in the same period. If you're unfamiliar with how energy consumption works in mining Bitcoin, here's a dive into that rabbit hole from Investopedia. Compliments of the Martins. Now, Tesla announced on February 8th that it had invested $1.5 billion in Bitcoin. The crypto that Icon investor Warren Buffett has called rat poison squared. Hey, way to go, Wall Streeter. Tesla's SEC filing also detailed for its investors the risks involved with that Bitcoin stake as follows. It says, quote, in January 2021, we updated our investment policy to provide us with more flexibility to further diversify and maximize return on our cash that's not required to maintain adequate operating liquidity. As part of that policy, which was approved, by the way, we may invest a portion of such cash in certain alternative reserve assets, including blah, 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 and Bitcoin. The prices of digital assets have been in the past and may continue to be highly volatile, including as a result of various associated risks and uncertainty. Moreover, their lack of physical form, reliance on technology for their creation, existence and transactional validation, and their decentralization may subject their integrity to the threat of malicious attacks and technological obsolescence. If we hold digital currencies and their values decrease relative to our purchase prices, our financial condition may be harmed. Now, it goes on and on and on and on, but Tesla sold its stake in Bitcoin, a good portion of it anyway, and now we have Musk's announcement. That's it for today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be back next Tuesday. Mel will be back tomorrow with Butch. Also be on the lookout for our weekly blog in your email inbox after the sunrise. Thanks for listening. Have a good evening, and please be safe out there. Bye.